Hey everyone, this is Tronsta here in the basement, and you are listening to the Basement Game Dev Podcast. I have on my left, on the big white fluffy sofa, Brett.
Hey.
And once again, we have the ever tall Tim Talley.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. For those who have not listened in the past or have forgotten where everyone works and what they do, let's go around and just say a little bit about our backgrounds. Starting with Tim.
Sure. I'm Tim Talley. I'm working at Firaxis, and I've got about 7 years in the game industry and four in governmental games before that.
I'm Brett Dorley. I'm a gameplay software engineer at Wargaming West, a partner of Wargaming.net.
Formerly Day One.
Formerly Day One, yes.
And I'm Tronster. I'm a programmer at Firaxis, and on the nights and weekends, I do stuff for Geek House Games, which is a little indie studio. The only thing we're really doing right now is one game a month, the challenge to make one game every month, and it's been fun. GDC is coming up. It's at the end of this month, guys. What do you think? You excited for, you know, what discoveries or talk will be coming out of GDC?
I'm excited to see what Sony's going to talk about with... I assume that they announced the PlayStation 4 before GDC, so that way they could talk to developers as a whole with it. At the time of recording, the Xbox has not been announced yet, so I don't know if Microsoft will be there in any type of presence talking about their console, but we should start to see information to a wider spectrum of developers about the new platforms.
Are you, Tim, anything?
Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't kept up on GDC too much. You know, you kind of sit back on your laurels every once in a while. You get into, you know, working 80-hour weeks at, you know, 2 years ago, and I just kind of fallen out since then.
Right. Well, I'm sure some of the top information will be coming out on Gamma Sutra and Polygon and what else? Kotaku, Joystick. But it should be good time, good information there. Before we delve into the topic, we'll throw announcements at the beginning of here. And, you know, if you want to listen to another podcast, and this is particularly relevant for the topic of this podcast, try checking out the Game Design Roundtable. It's a podcast that John Schaefer, the game designer for Civilization V, has. You can find the Game Design Roundtable on iTunes. And also, as always, we have up on Amazon a wish list. Look for the Basement Game Dev Podcast, because we're trying to get equipment, and rather than borrowing equipment and using some of my own personal equipment, it would be great. And okay, so the topic today is board games and card games and dice games and any type of non-video games and how they influence us when it comes to game design and game development. And, you know, growing up, I had only the simplest of board games. I had Candyland, Checkers, and the first card game I ever learned was War, which didn't have much strategy. It actually had no strategy at all. But later on was introduced to some more robust games such as Egyptian Rat Screw, Spoons. I'm trying to think what else out there. I was going to say Monopoly, but that's not super robust either, is it? You're just...
No, I mean, you could look at Monopoly as a diplomatic game as well. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that happens off the board from Monopoly that adds a lot of little creativity points.
Right. And and one I do have, I'd be very sad if I did not mention Connect Four, which is one of the best games of all time. And so I'm wondering,
he's like, also very good at Connect Four, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you, Brett. I will take anyone on any day. But tell me, you guys, like, what are some board games that have stood out to you? You know, you're full time game developers today, but like as children or when you're younger, first was an interest of you and back then, did you see a relation to those type of games and video games?
So I actually didn't get much into board games until much later. A friend of mine who now works at Ubisoft Toronto, John Rennish, really introduced me into like the more modern board games. As a kid, I played Monopoly and some other games, but I didn't necessarily get really big into them until much, much later in life. And in terms of direct influence I've seen from those, I remember the Sega Master System version of Monopoly, which is actually spelled Monopoly as two separate words on the cartridge. It wasn't nearly as fun as playing the actual game, but I mean, that was what, 8-bit Sega days, so.
Was the graphics or this was Genesis or Master System?
Master System.
Okay, so it wasn't the lack of blast processing that hadn't even come about.
No.
So was it just the graphics, or what are some aspects that made it not nearly as much fun being in digital form?
At the time, the Master System only had the D-pad and the two buttons. It didn't have a separate like start and select like the Nintendo had. And so the interface was just rather clumsy at the time. And it was a lot harder to play through the game than it was to pull out the board, roll some dice, move some things around. It was just clumsy interface.
Gotcha. Yeah, more limited in how you can interact with what's on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
How about you, Tim?
Oh, man. I played so many games. There's so many different things that kind of got me to where I am now. It's really hard to kind of put it on any specific one. Every time I go home, I tend to play dominoes with my grandparents. And so I think that's probably one of the biggest games that I would say. They call it Moon or 21, Bones or 42. I mean, all of those together. It's two-player, three-player, four-player dominoes.
I played Mexican Train. That's a different dominoes game?
That is a different dominoes game. I mean, you play that with 12 pips on your dominoes, and that specifically is one of my most hated games that we play as a family.
Well, you got to tell me what's so bad about Mexican Train.
There's literally no strategy in Mexican Train. Well, there's some strategy in Mexican Train. What I've liked to do, I play a lot of Texas Hold'em, and in Texas Hold'em, it's pretty much straightforward. Right, you get two hole cards, you get the flop, the turn, and then the river.
Right.
There's a lot of math that kind of gets into that as you start looking at what's out there, what your percentages are like to hit the next card or to hit your hand, and there's a lot of strategy that goes into reading the other players that are also at the table. So from that, you can gain an idea as to where you're sitting versus other people there and whether or not you're going to make that hand. So you can bet. There's strategies for betting. The whole concept is very deep.
And so when you were playing Texas Hold'em or dominoes type game that you played, did you see any correlation between those and video games, or those two completely separate worlds?
Well, it that's really kind of interesting. So what video games do really well is take a very monotonous action out of the gaming experience, because computers can do a lot of computations all at the same time.
Right.
So the more complex a board game is, the closer and better it is for an actual video game experience. The biggest problems that you have in video games is the human interaction, right? Sitting down with three players and have them do something that's kind of outside of the constructs of what the game is. So kind of delving into emergent gaming, if you will, right? That's why I feel like emergent gaming is so amazing, because there's things that are coming out of that you wouldn't necessarily have thought of before. And that's why games that you play around with your family and friends, that I think that's why it's so important to do that, because it's a fun aspect of the game.
I can understand that. There's I think I mentioned it, the game Spoons. And, by the rules of the game, once you have four of a kind or someone has four of a kind, you grab the spoon. And you could easily turn that into a digital version. What would be a little bit more difficult, not impossible with modern day, motion graphics or motion controls, is you grab your spoon and then, like some people do, take their hand and wipe it across the table, sending all the other spoons flying across the room, then having to scramble and go grab them. That doesn't translate super well into a video game.
You can make Johann Sebastian Joust's version of spoons.
That could be a fun game. That's the games you grew up with, and motion controls for today. What games are you playing today, which inspires you, or what board games are you playing today, which is keeping you off of video games?
Well, right now I'm actually playing two games. The first one is Hanafuda, the Koi Koi. It's how Nintendo got its start. Dave got me hooked on that one. And the other one is Mahjong. So both of those together. And now I'm not necessarily playing those in a social setting, but I'm actually playing the video game version of those to kind of get better at it. Now, I don't even remember where we're going with that.
Well, just, you know, how those games... I'm wondering, like, what games would you prefer to play rather than, you know, firing up a match of LOL or whatever games?
I don't really have any at the moment. I mean, Texas Hold'em is still one of my favorites, but there's nothing that really kind of keeps me away from, say, LOL.
So if someone came in there and said, hey, let's play a game of Go, and you had a LOL match also, you'd probably still go for the LOL match?
I'd have to finish up the LOL match, but I'd probably... Yeah, okay, you got me. I'd definitely sit down and play some Go.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying Zombicide right now, which is a co-op survival game where you try to fight zombies. It's very hard. I don't think I've actually beat it yet with the group of people I play with, but mostly the co-op board games or the more social games such as Dixit or Apples to Apples or Say Anything, things like that, that are really just more of a social or party game rather than a more of a hardcore board game.
Yeah, that's pretty good. You know, I'm trying to think like what I'm even playing today. Most of the new board games I'm playing are ones that Brett, you introduced me to when I'm hanging out with friends and there's like a game night. There was some game I played where you had to wear a headband and you took feathers, like Indian feathers, and you stuck them in the headband. And those numbers where you had to guess what the maximum number was because you could see everyone else's headbands, everyone else's feathers, but your own.
That's Indian poker, if I remember right.
It's Indian poker.
Yeah, Indian poker.
Okay, I guess then it was a formalized version of Indian poker, mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it was a ton of fun. There was some math involved, but it wasn't a ridiculous amount of math. And it was fun because you're just hanging out with people and you get to see the expressions of everyone's faces. So I'm wondering, like, when you guys play video games, do you ever have a camera like an iToy or use what the equivalent is on the Xbox so you can then see to the people you're playing against or in multiplayer games?
That's so dangerous. dangerous. I do not want to see other people naked on their cameras. I turn that off.
Is that an issue? Does that still come up? Oh, okay. I don't have a camera, so can't say. Tim, do you ever use the camera or no?
No. I don't do much gaming at home anymore. With my roommate and his kid. So I tend to do something that all three of us can do together. So getting online and just playing an online game at home, that's a little more difficult.
It's funny. This is a problem that's been pervasive. Like I think I remember our director, Steve Meyer, saying back in the 80s when he was working on arcades, there was some game he was working on, and they either made or were going to make, I think they said they made a prototype that had a camera in it and the players could take their own picture and it would put it in the game. And this is the early 80s, and they did not ship the final game with that feature because what people wanted to put on the camera was not what the developers originally had intended.
The TTP.
Yeah, the TTP, time to, and then you can find the body part to put there. But with board games, you don't have to worry about that so much unless you have someone bring like a crazy friend. And then there's TTP, but I've never known people to get naked in the board games I play. Yeah, let's go away from that corner. Let's go back to topic. So board games and dice games, and do you guys ever make little video game systems or ever get inspired to make an AI or a game table or a game world based on something you're doing with physical game pieces or game objects?
I kind of actually think the other way because I've been playing more board games lately and less video games just because I need to get away from the screen a little bit. I kind of think about some of the games that I have played and how they would translate into a more physical form instead of the digital form. So kind of the reverse of what you're saying.
Is there any concrete ideas you can share on this, or?
Not at the moment.
Oh, son of a mother. Okay. How about you, Tim?
Well, I've always been fascinated with languages and the idea of taking a card game and kind of building that into a language learning device. I thought that was kind of an interesting idea. So it's like Rosetta Stone, you know? So for me, there's a certain amount of education and a certain amount of mental ability that I like in games. So the board games tend to have a lot more of that because the video games, you tend to be a little more twitch-based. I mean, XCOM is kind of a little bit of a different example because you can move pieces around, your units around, and there's a lot more numbers that you start to have to look at in order to perform well. So those sorts of strategy-type games, I feel, translate really well from video games into board games and vice versa.
Man, that would be so amazing, XCOM the board game. I think, Brett, you said, or maybe it was you, Tim, someone had mentioned about the numbers, and as you start adding more and more numbers, it makes it so that a game lends itself to be better on the computer than in some sort of physical form. But
yeah, that's kind of the interesting puzzle that I was talking about before. It's there are so many numbers in the video game, and it's trying to pull out and figure out what are the minimal parts of the video game to still have the fun and the same concept of the video game as the board game, essentially. And it's just trying to narrow down exactly which parts are the ones worth keeping to lower that number so it can be brought into the physical space.
Right. And I could definitely see that being applicable to turn-based strategy games, maybe even to RTS. You know, in many interviews that they've had with Jake, he would talk about paper prototyping for XCOM. And I only assume there's some prototyping of that nature going on when Civilization V was being made, or the expansion. For action games, like I'm wondering, Brett, Fear 3 was a first-person shooter. I mean, was there paper prototyping, a board game that was used on any in the game itself, or at least systems of the game?
Not necessarily. There were some paper diagrams made of the basic level layout, so you could kind of see the flow of how the level is going to go before they started to build it into 3D. But that was the extent of that.
How about Fracture?
None that I can recall.
Okay.
I feel like MMOs actually lend themselves really well to a pen and paper sort of way. So like taking WoW or one of the games I had worked on in the past, you can take out some of those combat systems and roll them into like a D20 Dungeons and Dragons style game. And you can play it and you can go on quests. And so a lot of that you can really kind of adapt out. But the play mechanics to where this person's over here and that fast-paced action of targeting and firing, right? I mean, you have that in LOL. You can't really translate something like League of Legends over into pen and paper very well. You can kind of slow down World of Tanks in a subtle way, right? I mean, you can kind of.
It's already a relatively slow action game.
So. Right, yeah. So, and because of that, you can kind of translate the mediums pretty well.
Okay.
Well, take a look, for example, Mech Assault, which is a BattleTech IP, so it was originally from a board game and then went into a video game and kind of sped up to be that interactive. It's kind of going the opposite way, but you can take an action shooter game and bring it into a physical medium, essentially.
Which is pretty good, because I did try playing the board game version of that in middle school at a like Friday night event, and I thought we'd get like an hour in, get a quick game, do other stuff, but that it was all Friday night, and I was not nearly prepared for the amount of dice rolling that had to occur. But totally unrelated, are either of you ever addicted to counters? It's having a lot of counters. Is that just me?
Like having a lot of dice laying around? Or?
Yeah, like, you know, just being attracted to buying dice or buying colored beads or, like, I found something one of you said, like, made me flash back to my Magic days. And at the local game store at Towson, I was ranked number 2 out of everyone. And I blame my friend Brian Schneider, who I think he's now working at Zynga, but for a while he worked at Wizards of the Coast. And before he was even at Wizards, he was playing Magic, and I think he played on the Pro Tour, and his brothers played, and very, very good guy. Except he did threaten to make a Tronster card once, and that would have been awful, because then people think my name would have been named after a Magic card. No one would believe the vice versa. So,
what color would that card have been?
It would have been gold. I don't know why either. He told me this. It would have been a gold, multicolored card. I don't know what it was. Yeah, so...
What two colors?
Maybe it was 3?
Blue?
I don't
know. Yeah, I would assume it would have been a blue.
Yeah, I assume it was blue.
I had a really mean blue-black deck that was amazing. You know, counter spells. But second only to my mill deck. But, you know, and it's funny. The decks in Magic speak a lot to one's personality and all. And games like that allow that level of customization. Same thing with the counters, whether you decide to keep hit points, track of hit points with dice or a piece of paper and pencil or however, these are other ways that help you enjoy the game. You know, what are some of the things that game designers can do, you know, that to allow that ancillary stuff to go and be fun for players too? Or is that so inconsequential that game developers should not be thinking of level of customization when it comes in terms of how much life your character has left, or just, you know, how you keep track of score?
I'm trying to make the leap between what sort of the elements in a game. So, like, the thing that came to me immediately was World of Warcraft, right? Where a person who would take their character and just switch out all these new elements onto their character, you know, changing out their armor, changing the way that they look, not based on the stats, but based on the way that they look, just because that's the way that they kind of wanted to do it. I don't know. I think creating a game that is abstract enough to where you can allow the player to do those sorts of things, I think that adds that element that you're looking for, you know, that tech creation element. Something that adds your own personal creativity to shine throughout the game.
That's good. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, or some more concrete examples also. World of Warcraft is great. I know that even like the user interface, there are mods people have and decide what shows up or where the map exists on their screen, what hotkeys are mapped to, not even what's on the keyboard, but even if they have keyboard extensions. Like you, like Tim, you have a really neat keyboard extension for LOL, right?
Yeah, just like a little keypad that I keep over on my left side so I can use the hotkeys really fast. I mean, it's the little edges that give you an advantage, right?
Right, but and you find that fun, though, right? Having that all there, that adds to your enjoyment of the game.
Much more so, because there are also larger keys. My hands are a little too big for a natural keyboard, so trying to reconfigure a keyboard to my hands is a little more difficult. That keypad was perfect, because I could not only hotkey my specific, like, I want to level up the spell 1, right, or spell 2 or spell 3. I mean, I could do that pretty quickly.
Let's see. Another example would be, like, Minecraft. It's very popular. But there are tons of, like, graphic packs out there now and sound packs out. And the original developer, you know, Mojang, did not plan for that to happen. It's just people started modding it. Even in XCOM, you know, I've seen on the forums, apparently people have been grabbing the PC's version and doing all sorts of stuff, which is surprising to me. Has that been happening on any old Day One properties?
Not that I can recall off the top of my head.
Like, I'm wondering, like, as game developers, again, you guys are, let's say, on your own project, and you get to go and decide, you know, certain aspects of it. Like, how much importance do you put into modding, or is it dangerous to allow that level of customization early in on a project to allow the player to change some of the core ways that the game's going to work to go and match their style or their preference?
That really depends on the purpose of the game. I mean, the more customization you have in a game that is multiplayer, in which other players can grief and affect each other, it's something that you probably don't want to have. but then having like user-generated maps are kind of cool at the same time. It depends on if you are trying to make a lot of money out of the game through microtransactions or something, and allowing users to do modifications allows them to get around the microtransactions that you're trying to, you know, put roofs over the heads of all of your employees on. So it really depends. I mean, if it's a single-player experience that you're not affecting anybody else by allowing users to mod it, go for it. Great. Allow them to do whatever they want. But in games where it can affect other people, I would say it's fine to not necessarily have that level of customization or outside interference of the game, essentially, because that's essentially what a mod is. It's a way of changing the game from the outside rather than the inside.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at it from that same perspective, like what I was saying about the keyboard being more efficient. It's small little hacks that give you an advantage. So in a way, it's kind of like cheating to have something that someone else doesn't necessarily have. So mods can be very dangerous, but you also see a lot of creativity come from that. So I think the better idea is to start to look about how to create a game that is generic enough to allow the user to have their own experience, but within the same confines of the game itself. So I kind of go back to a card game called Mao. It's like a Crazy Eights meets Uno meets like build your own whatever. The idea is that you start out and you just keep playing. And if a person who's new to the game doesn't know how to play the game, you're not supposed to tell them the rules. They're supposed to figure out how to play the game by watching the game. And every time someone wins, they end up getting to create their own rules. So something new starts to happen, and it kind of develops from there. And so there's a lot of creativity that comes into it, and there's a lot of new dynamic things that happen from that. But that's the constructs of the game itself.
It almost sounds like I'm going to make a broad sweeping rule that it's much safer and easier to go and allow modding of paper-based games, that be board or dice, than it is online games. Because while computer game, or I should say any computer game, because computer games will allow for things to be more computationally intensive and can handle that with a greater of ease, it's at the cost of security and cheating and, you know, the fact that everyone's not physically there to be able to see what is going on. Mm-hmm. Not to say you can't cheat in card games. And I do remember playing Magic the Gathering against a guy in the mall, and whenever he'd draw a card, I realized sometimes he was drawing two cards at one time and just holding them close together. But okay, so we're coming down to the end here. Went almost a little off the main path here. But do you guys have any other thoughts on the role that dice, board, or card games have played with game development, or a board game that you think everyone should play? That game developers should play that might be inspiring to them?
Well, okay. So over the Christmas break, my aunt got me onto this website called Luminosity.com. I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's one of those brain games sort of game where you go on there and it's supposed to expand your memory or expand your speed or whatever. And as I was playing the games, I did really well immediately on all the games, and ended up in like the 90th percentile and everything, which apparently is pretty good.
Nice.
Right, yeah. And some of the games were very spatially oriented, to where like you basically, something would pop up on the screen and you'd have to click that same area, and then like seven things would pop up on the screen and you'd have to click all seven of them. It didn't really matter in the order. And where I'm going with that is that basically I saw a translation between that specific game and something like the game of Go or the game of chess, where an actual board game, your visualized memory is so impacted by that game that the more that you play, the more that you've expanded your mind into those different arenas. So from the board games, I feel like you get those spatial orientations. I feel like you get a lot more memory. I feel like you get a lot more speed. And it goes back to a paper that I wrote in college about the psychology of games and your perception spheres. This is basically what I call a perception sphere, is you notice what's around you right now. Like, we know that there's two people, but let's say you're in a car driving down the highway and you notice just the car in front of you or the cars to your sides. All those things you can start to track. In video games, however, playing something like Quake 3, I'll kind of have to go back to that. Playing Quake 3, you get a lot more people coming in at the same time and start to affect how you hear things, how you see things, how you interact with those objects. And the paper that I was writing is basically how something like Quake 3 ends up creating a real-world attribute, right? Like, not only is your adrenaline going faster in that same sort of experience playing Quake 3, but you also start to track a lot more objects coming in. All these rockets that are flying at you, trying to dodge all these different things while hitting a jump shot, you know, hitting a rail gun. All these things actually create a good environment to where I started to, after months of play, be able to start to track not only the car in front of me, but six cars in front of me, and start to notice behaviors of all the different cars and label them, you know, aggressive drivers, passive drivers, and actually became a better driver because of that, because now I can see all these different people around me and what they're trying to do. So I feel like there's a good correlation between video games and some of these real world applications, and as well as board games.
And what was the name of the website you had mentioned at the beginning of there?
Yeah, the Luminosity.com.
Luminosity.com. Okay. How about you, Brett? Is there any board game that you've been playing that, you know, if someone's like, hey, I'm a game developer, I want to play a fun board game, something that might just provide some inspiration, what board game would you recommend?
Tucero is a pretty good game. It's just a path-laying game, where you're just basically trying to be the last one to survive. I've played that with you, Tronster. Mm-hmm. And it's a very fun, simple game, but there's a lot of depth to the strategy and how you play the game. It's worth checking out.
Oh, definitely. Particularly to see the expression on one of the players' faces when you send them off the board and mm-hmm. make them unhappy.
So. Kind of like Carcassonne?
Not exactly. Carcassonne's like a big, giant, like...
Tile-based game, sure.
Yeah, this is much more... Like, you can play a game of Tucero in 5 minutes.
Oh, all right. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's good. And I'll throw out one, like, a game that I had never played against the board itself that I've really enjoyed, and it's not new, it's been out for a while, is called Shadows Over Camelot. And it's a game where all the players are working together to beat the board, and the board's trying to beat them. But maybe one of the players might be a traitor, in which case you're against the board and you're against one of the other players. So it's fun, and it's definitely, once I played it the first time and saw that mechanic, I don't know quite how it inspired me in the game development scene, but I know it definitely tweaked something inside my brain. Hopefully it's doing good things. I've looked at making these games. Okay, guys, well, that's it for time. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and listening to the Basement Game Dev Podcast. After GDC in April, we'll be back with more. And until then, keep making games.